live every weekday at noon, and then as a podcast, this is MoneyWeb at midday. I'm Jimmy Moyaha, standing in for Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes of express news on the latest developments in South Africa and around the world, including interviews with business and political leaders, prominent newsmakers, and top commentators. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the cracks that appear to be forming in the Government of National Unity. We get an expert to take a look at what needs to be done to ensure that this government stays intact. Then we have a conversation around the latest case brought by the South African Human Rights Commission before the Equality Court related to a Member of Parliament. We also reflect on the same Member of Parliament being a gentleman by the name of Ronaldo Gous and the response by the political party he's a member of, choosing to suspend the MP pending an investigation. Then we have a conversation around the use of artificial intelligence for diagnosis and screening tests in tuberculosis. And then we wrap up with a sense of inflation numbers and how coffee costs you a lot more to drink.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As the dust settles on the Government of National Unity and the realities that confront it, there are a lot of questions that still remain unanswered and a lot that needs to be decided on. One of those things is the cabinet that would be appointed by the president of the 7th administration. Another one of those is how we actually make all of this work. I'm joined on the line by Professor Jolene Steyn-Kotze, who's chief research specialist in democracy and citizenship at the Human Science Research Council. She's also a research fellow at the Center for Gender and African Studies at the University of the Free State. Prof. Kotze, good day. Thanks so much for taking the time. What do we do at this point? What's needed to make the Government of National Unity work?
Good morning. Thank you. It's been quite an interesting, I think, area to observe, most notably around elite political behavior and contestation, because we have noticed, for example, that there's already some indication, around elites contesting for specific roles within a government of national unity. Those within the Progressive Caucus saying, for example, well, we are going to withdraw our councillors at local level if, you know, the following does not happen. And I'm quite curious to see if, as this GNU progresses, whether our political elites will start demonstrating a level of political maturity towards a politics of collaboration instead of, I would say, what we are seeing now, more a politics of contestation for positioning.
Prof. Kotze, what are the four crucial factors that they need to get right as the leaders of, or the elected leaders of South Africa in order for this to work?
Well, the research body is pretty clear that when you are in a situation of a coalition, or, you know, whether you call it a coalition or a government of national unity, you are dealing with an elite pact. And for those reasons, you need to have more of your softliner leaders coming in. So that means leaders who are more open to compromise, leaders who are more open to kind of say, well, let's agree to disagree, but we do need to set a policy agenda for the next 5 years. Can we get some commitment around what our key priorities would be? Regardless of our ideological disagreements. So the ability to compromise, the ability to work together. Also, I would argue to avoid divisive political rhetoric would also be key for this GNU to work.
Prof. Kotze, we are awaiting a cabinet announcement or an announcement of what the new 7th administration cabinet will look like from the president. What would you like to see in that regard that supports these structures or supports what the government of national unity needs to look like in order for us to achieve sustainable change in a meaningful way forward?
You know, that is a very difficult question to answer because, of course, it opens up the possibility that we are going to find cabinet ministers who are appointed, you know, kind of based on what the negotiations within the GNU elite pact was. I think ideally what I would have liked to see was more of a public discussion around what the priority areas of the GNU would be and how best the different ministries would work together in order to support those priorities. Because as it stands now, I think there's very little public engagement around, what are our key focuses, for example, in re-kickstarting the economy? What is our key focus in terms of public health, especially if we notice, if we take note of the NHI bill, the National Health Insurance? So a little bit more public discussion around those critical issues, I think, is absolutely critical in order to start shaping who is going to do what in terms of achieving those priorities, and not necessarily who is going to do what in terms of the agreement we have reached as our political elites within this pact.
Prof Kotso, early rumblings are starting around the fact that this current government of national unity is not sustainable. There's too many cracks that are showing. There's too many differences in opinions on policy and those sorts of things. What do you say to that?
It is still early days, and I do think that, you know, within these early days, this is where your elite's political values, behavior, habits, the way of doing politics, I think, is something that we are still seeing kind of this antagonistic posturing that political parties and political elites have when they engage one another. And that is actually the critical area where political elites need to not just negotiate what the GNU is going to look like, but actually negotiate their own behavior and their own habits within a GNU scenario. We are no longer in a situation where you have political parties as your rivals and that you are contesting power. You are now in a situation where your rival becomes your collaborator, and you do need to move more towards a softer position to achieve what is needed in order to set those priorities, as opposed to the very hardline positions that we have often seen, where political parties would say, well, if I can't get what I want, then I'm just going to withdraw, and that is going to put others in a very difficult position. And it is also a contributing factor around governance instability that we have seen play out at a local government level.
The foundations need to be reinforced if this GNU is to succeed. We'll leave it at that, Prof. Thanks so much, Prof. Jolene Steyn-Kotse, joining me to reflect on the current state of the Government of National Unity and what crucial things need to be looked at.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Speaking of crucial things that need to be looked at, now is not the time to have divisiveness within the country, and something that has been dividing us along all social lines, especially on social media, has been the recent developments of a member of parliament uttering racial incidences or racial utterances and hate speech. I'm joined on the line by the South African Human Rights Commission Commissioner, Sandra Makwasha, to take a look at this. Good evening, Sandra. Sorry, good day, Sandra. Thanks so much for the time. What prompted the South African Human Rights Commission to approach the Equality Court on this matter?
Good day to Jimmy and your listeners. What prompted the Human Rights Commission to take this matter to court is that we are mandated by the Constitution, firstly, to protect constitutional democracy, but secondly, also in terms of the Equality Act, to ensure that hate speech, speech that is deemed to be racist or has elements of racism, is then taken into account. So that is why we took this matter to the Equality Court.
Commissioner, what outcome are you looking for in this regard, whether it's from the Equality Court, whether it's from the political parties concerned? What outcome are you hoping to achieve?
So firstly, in respect of the Equality Court, we have made a number of prayers to the Equality Court. One of them is that the respondent pay a sum of money to an NGO that is primarily dealing with social coercion. The other one is that Mr. Kruse sends out a written apology to the Human Rights Commission, publishes on his social media. So the whole idea is to assist in social coercion. This is something the Human Rights Commission is very passionate about, as seen in our programs such as Shine.
Commissioner, the videos or the evidence that's in question that's been brought forward here that raised the concern, these clips aren't from yesterday. They're from quite some time ago when we look at some of the timestamps on the videos. Why are we dealing with the matter now? Why wasn't it dealt with in the past?
So the Human Rights Commission became aware of it on the evening of Wednesday. So immediately after we became aware of it, we realized that, yes, this video is 14 years old. However, the harm was felt again on Wednesday. So once that harm took place again, and there's jurisprudence that has been established by the Equality Court in a number of cases, it's not when the offending, media piece or the utterance took place. It's when the harm is felt. And we actually, in one of our prayers, we're asking the Equality Court to make that determination again in respect of this particular matter so that there is no issue of what we call in the legal world prescription of this matter.
Commissioner, what's to happen going forward? I mean, you mentioned the harm aspect of it. Is it going to be the case that every time something like this resurfaces, regardless of whether it's been dealt with in the past or not, we're going to then pursue action against the respondent? Or is this a matter of it has never been addressed or dealt with in the past, and therefore this is why this is the first time?
It has never been addressed and dealt with in the past, and this is the first time we became aware of it, and that's why we're taking such decisive steps against it to ensure that the public is aware that everything that happens online, we are monitoring, and steps will be taken if it is found to be offensive or crosses that line that we then deem in terms of the Equality Act.
Commissioner, has the Human Rights Commission approached the respondent directly prior to engaging the Equality Court to see if we can get some form of resolution other than having to go through the courts?
We have not. However, the Act, the Empowering Act, the Equality Act, does empower us to go directly to the Equality Court. There is nothing that stops the respondent from approaching the Human Rights Commission and advising that he would like to then have a conversation. However, given the nature as well as the office that the respondent holds, the Commission felt right that this matter be dealt with at the Equality Court.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Thanks so much for those insights, Commissioner Sandra Makwasha of the South African Human Rights Commission, on their decision to approach the Equality Court over remarks made by Member of Parliament Ronaldo Khos.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in response to these developments from the South African Human Rights Commission, we have had a response from the political party that Mr. Khos is a part of, that is the Democratic Alliance. I'm about to play a soundbite by Helen Ziller, the chairperson of the DA's Federal Council. Let's take a listen.
Ronaldo Khos has been suspended from party activities in the Democratic Alliance with immediate effect. This follows the surfacing of a video in which Ronaldo uses execrable and totally unacceptable language that are directly opposed to the value system of the Democratic Alliance. His case has been referred to the Federal Legal Commission, and if he wants to state his defense, he will be able to do so there. But till then, he is suspended from all party activities, and we await the outcome of his disciplinary hearing.
I'm joined on the line now by Chris Vick, former government communicator and a spin doctor, to take a look at this particular position from the Democratic Alliance. Good day, Chris. Thanks so much for taking the time. Is this reputation management by the Democratic Alliance?
I think it's poor reputation management. I mean, Mr. Khos has been a member of the DA since 2012. He's held public office since 2016. He's been posting this sort of vile racist commentary on social media for years. I don't understand why the DA let him stand for public office in Parliament. I don't know why they were so hesitant to act against him in the first place, questioning whether the videos were real or not. And I think their response is very hesitant and very reluctant. They should have come out very clearly and said this is racist and it's offensive, rather than using fancy language to say it's very bad. It's almost as if they're reprimanding him rather than acting very decisively.
Chris, how should the Democratic Alliance be moving forward with this in the context of the Government of National Unity? We know that everybody involved in this new structure has opposing views on varying policies, on varying stances, but I think the one thing that South Africans as a whole commonly understand and commonly agree on is that there's very little place, if any, for racism in South Africa, if that is what this is going to be classified as, and this is what has been brought forward to the courts.
Well, I think there needs to be some looking backwards before there's looking forwards. And I am very surprised, given the high horse that the DA likes to ride on, that Mr. Khosa was allowed to make it through to the nomination process. I mean, it says something about the DA's internal processes that they were either not aware or not concerned about the way he's behaved on social media in the past. So I think some introspection's needed as to how somebody who speaks like this or even thinks like this makes it to be nominated for a position in parliament. Going forward, you know, I think the difficulty for the DA is this reinforces the perception that many people in South Africa have, which is that the DA is protective, that it's not honest about race, it doesn't want to have race conversations. It's lost so many prominent black leaders, you know, that I think it really does pose questions in people's minds about how sincere it is in being not only non-racial but anti-racist. That's point number one. I think in terms of the Government of National Unity, the DA is not really excelling in terms of how it's communicating at the moment. It's trying to impose a form of baskap or a colonialism that it is in charge, and it's not. It didn't get the majority of votes in the election. It's a partner, and it's not acting like a partner. It's trying to act as a gatekeeper in terms of how things happen, who else is part of the Government of National Unity. And unfortunately, what I think that does in the minds of many South Africans is just reinforce this perception of arrogance, not humiliation. The ANC is portraying a sense of humiliation. It's been humbled at the polls. The Patriotic Alliance is doing the same. The IFP is being very realistic about the level of support it's got. And yet the DA is increasingly strident about the position it holds. And that doesn't send good signals, you know. I think there's a very positive mood that exists around how the election outcome was received, except for the MK party. There's a very positive mood around the progress that's being made with the GNU. And the DA just looks like the spanner in the works, and the perception is one of arrogance and superiority. And the Ronaldo Khosa thing is a little bit of a sideshow. It's a serious sideshow. But it's just reinforcing that perception of a party that is not humble, that is not sensitive to the views of the majority of South Africans, and is not responding to that properly.
Sensitivity has always been associated with these sorts of conversations, especially where we deal with issues of racism in whatever form they may take. Chris, before I let you go, is this something that could cause the Government of National Unity to fall apart, or to at least have other parties consider the DA a non-member in the future?
I don't think so. I don't think it's a deal breaker. I think there are other bigger issues that are more likely to be deal breakers. It's just yet another notch on the DA stick, you know, and one it needs to be aware of. But I think there are much more fundamental issues at stake. And as I say, what Mr. Khosa has done is vile and offensive and racist, but I don't think it's a deal breaker. I think there are many other issues that are likely to be deal breakers. This is just really bad for the DA's public image.
Reputation. We'll leave it at that. Chris, thanks so much for those insights. Chris Vick, former government communicator and spin doctor, sharing his thoughts on the DA's response to the allegations against Mr. Ronaldo Khosa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
This week, the health department is having a conference of TB experts in an effort to find new ways and new creative ways to accelerate the diagnosis of TB and silicosis. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Mpora Bada, who is a technical specialist on occupational health diseases at the National Health Department, to take a look at this and understand what's been going on here. Good day, Dr. Bada. Thanks so much for taking the time. You're currently in the midst of a conference. How is the conference going, and what is top of mind there?
Good day to you and your listeners. The conference is going very well, with people from all over the world who are experts basically a mixture of healthcare experts, computer specialists who do this CAD. And so far, it's doing very well. It's going very well.
Dr. Rabada, now, one of the interesting themes that's emerged or one of the talking points around this year's conference is the integration or the use of artificial intelligence as a tool to accelerate screening and diagnosis. Can you just run us through the importance of that and how we got to looking at this as a potential option?
Yeah, I mean, we live in a world where it's resource constraints. There are competing needs, and we in a bid to stretch the rent, you know, you've got to come with innovative solution, embracing the fourth industrial revolution, to expand healthcare, to increase access, quality, and ensure equity. So computer aided diagnosis is just one of those that is able to lower the cost, at the same time increasing access. And I think the importance of the conference, of course, as one of the outputs, is making sure that there's no misdiagnosis. So, I mean, a dongle or the software can run through 1,000 x-rays in 10 minutes and then come up, you know, with the screening results. So that capability, or you know, it makes it a point that the care that we provide is timeous. But number two, in the absence of radiologists, of course, which we know that there are fewer of those, so this becomes a resource to use to ensure that we get the proper diagnosis in terms of screening, and then so we can then link those people to definitive care.
Dr. Rabada, we have global goals. We have goals as a country to end TB by 2035. In looking towards things like artificial intelligence to help accelerate this, how much more effective and efficient does it make your role as a medical professional when you're able to process that amount of data and help that many people in such a short space of time?
You know what? This is immense, because what it does also, it makes us to hone on those that has been screened as abnormal, and then we are then able to concentrate on those, link them to care, do case management. And remember, the thing about TB is to reduce the infective pool, because one person will infect 10 others, etc. So the more you can screen and timeous diagnosis means that you can then be able to get those people into care and stop the spread. The only way to end this global pandemic by 2035 is actually to stop the spread by intensive case funding. And AI is definitely an enabler in this intensive case finding.
Dr. Rabada, when we look at artificial intelligence and the integration around the world, obviously organizations like the World Health Organization have been promoting the use of computer-aided detection software. Are we going to see more practical applications perhaps around taking it a step further than just a diagnosis and a screening to perhaps treatment or assisting in treatment, or is that still too far away?
Look, it's a bit stretching it. But definitely is what we're looking for or looking forward to. For now, we've deployed this, I mean, into 15 containers, 23 mobiles, where it's actually working and yielding very good results. And as you know, there's a shortage of healthcare workers. And the more you've got this aided software, you are able to even cover those areas which are inaccessible. And then moving into the future, we're saying, watch this space. This one is already working. And I think what is important, what I want just to highlight, is the work on silicosis. You know, the work on silicosis, we're still perfecting it. And once we perfect it, of course, we'll be the first in the world to actually perfect it. And silicosis, it's a disease that, of course, comes from dust in the mines, silica dust, and is compensable. So we also, the other aspect of it is just to make sure that those with silicosis we can diagnose and then pay them. We have already done, you know, running trials, and I think in the next 2 months we will also have perfected the silicosis aspect of it.
Leveraging the power of artificial intelligence to improve diagnosis and screening. We'll leave it at that, Dr. Rabada. Dr. Mpho Rabada, Technical Specialist on Occupational Health Diseases with the Department of National Health.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And we wrap things up on a lighter note. We're taking a look at the inflation data that's come out. It suggests that while inflation has been quite reasonable over the last little bit of time, certain things have not been, and that's the price of coffee. It seems you're now paying more for your coffee because the price of coffee beans and other things have gone up. I'm joined on the line by Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB, Paul Magube, to take a look at this. Good day, Paul. Thanks so much for the time. Inflation not really the factor or the focal point here. What's happening in the coffee space?
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me. Good afternoon to your listeners as well. Yes, the dynamics about the inflation in the coffee complex is mainly externally driven, is mainly due to developments on the international market. We are a net importer of the raw material, coffee beans, and the situation on the international market is that prices have skyrocketed mainly due to weather related issues in the production areas, mainly of Brazil and Vietnam, which both are biggest producers of coffee in the world.
Paul, when we look at the other components that go into a typical cup of coffee, things like the sugar and the milk components of it, are we seeing any inflationary pressures on commodities like sugar?
Not as big as we see in the raw commodity. In the case of coffee, so on that side, the inflation is not that significant. But if you look at the coffee, it's quite huge. We're talking about over 30% year on year for coffee at the moment.
Paul, is this likely to be a sustainable kind of inflation that we're going to see stick around for a bit of time? I had a look at the food inflation overall in South Africa, and that seems to have come down quite significantly. And that suggests that this is probably isolated, as you said, to just one space. Is this likely to persist, or are we expecting a normalization at some point?
It's likely to, take hold for the rest of the year at elevated trends. Before tapering off into 2025 as the situation on the international market improves. Unfortunately, that is the current situation. Fortunately, in the inflation basket, there are other commodities that are food commodities that have been slowly coming down, which is positive for the consumer. But you'll have some sticky ones such as coffee, whose fundamentals are mostly external driven.
Paul, is it worth switching to tea at this point, or is the tea inflation just as bad?
Switching is a question of taste and preferences. It depends on consumers whether they will ditch coffee now, but it doesn't look like that, given the fact that if you look at the other food commodities, there's been a downtrend, and if you look at the fuel on the fuel side, we had a cut this month. We are probably going to have another cut next month. So the pressure on the consumer easing off on the other side. So it might not necessarily be that you have to switch to tea for now, except if we have a runaway prices in the medium term.
Paul, are we seeing international supply start to have concerns around the pricing? Are we seeing people seeking out alternative places to import from other than Brazil and Vietnam? Or is it just everybody's pricing in the increases and we're just having to pass it on?
Well, it's a question of who can supply. And those are the major suppliers. If the major suppliers don't have product, you automatically have a shortage on the market, and supplies will be remain relatively tight until the situation improves. So, in terms of our alternatives, limited alternatives take time to for the consumers to to adjust. In some instances, therefore, you're likely to have these elevated prices, but demand not diminishing rapidly.
Demand certainly not diminishing. People still willing to pay a little more for their Starbucks. Thanks so much, Paul, for those insights. Paul Makube, Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB, on the increase in coffee prices.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
That's been the show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, the show is live at noon weekdays and then available as a podcast. We'll be back next week. I'll still be standing in for Jeremy on a Monday. For now, thanks for listening and goodbye.